We're going to start. So thank you everyone for coming to today's Friday Safe Trek Seminar. We hold these Friday seminars on a semi-weekly basis on transportation safety issues and other issues that are broadly related to transportation. Funding for this program was provided by the California Office of Traffic Safety through the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. And today we're delighted to be joined by Fletcher
Botek.
Thank you. Who will be speaking about urban SIM and applications of the program to transportation issues. Dr. Botai has 8 years of experience implementing high-performance database algorithms as a programmer for a small startup in Princeton, New Jersey, before coming back to school at UC Berkeley and working with Paul Waddell as his doctoral advisor. He's now the chief data scientist and co-founder with Waddell of the firm Synthesity. And so now I'm going to pass it over to Fletcher. For those of us who are viewing remotely, we will have you on mute, but we'll be monitoring the chat window, so feel free to add questions in.
Great. So, like you said, my name is Fletcher. It's good to be back. Actually, I used to live like right there, and actually used to have an office down
the conference has been muted.
That's great. a lot of the city planning professors have, I guess it's the UCTC thing, so they have off-campus offices, and they get a discount, and just put their money towards offices here. So I was here for a year. So I'm going to talk about an intro to urban simulation. I'll keep it high level, assume that you have basically no familiarity with this at all. Give some context and then go into some details. We had an intro already, but I'll just say I got my PhD May of last year, so coming up on my one-year anniversary. My research was primarily in representing walking, walkability, and relating that to home values using models of home values, primarily looking for a new pattern of a relationship between home values and walkability in the Bay Area, and San Francisco in particular. I began that quest. I wouldn't say that I proved the case unequivocally, but it was a lot of fun to do that. And I am now a chief data scientist with Synthesity, and Synthesity is actually undergoing a shift of ownership at this point, so more news will come about that soon. I can't really tell you too much more, especially with being on the phone. quick overview, table of contents, talk about what urban simulation is. I'll give you a case study of the Plan Bay Area, which is the regional environmental impact report, which I did. I had a big part in the modeling for that. We'll talk about predicting land use, and then we'll switch to the travel side. And if we have time, we can go into some other travel-based metrics. If we don't have time, that's fine, too. I probably have the nerdiest Pinterest that exists. I find that Pinterest is a really great way to collect resources, and so I'll just pin bookmarks of interesting urban simulation, how to get into programming with Python, interesting startups in the smart cities space. I'll usually pin it on one of these boards, and when I make a presentation, I usually just throw together some screenshots from my Pinterest. So you feel free to ask anything that you see on the Pinterest site, well, not just what's in this presentation. So what is urban simulation? Highest level view, we are given population and job growth assumptions. To us, they're assumptions. To someone else, they're the results of another arduous modeling journey where they look at demographic trends and economic trends and that sort of thing. When they come to us, there's a set of growth assumptions. So the Bay Area is going to grow by 50% over the next 20 years, something like that. And you can actually move it down and move it up and see how that impacts the result. Our job doing, you know, we've primarily been in the land use modeling world, so our job is primarily to predict the location of future households and jobs, where the buildings will get built, especially in light of changes in preferences and demographic shifts and that sort of thing. The real purpose for doing this is to predict the demand for infrastructure. This is almost always in the context of a regional transportation plan, an RTP, and these are 30-year time horizon plans to make sure that we have enough transportation infrastructure, highways, transit lines, and everything else in order to meet the future demand for transportation. This is mandated by law. Every region in the United States, something like 430 of them, have an MPO, which is a regional transportation body, which is one of their several jobs, and perhaps their primary job, is to create this transportation plan. And these days, there are a number of different things they look at, all sorts of impacts. The biggest one in the California context, the single biggest metric that they look at is greenhouse gas emissions per capita or for the whole region. A lot of what we do is driven by greenhouse gas emissions at this point. Pretty good proxy for VMT, pretty good proxy for traffic, pretty good proxy for time spent commuting, all those sorts of things. I always get asked, is it SimCity for real? And I like to get it out of the way up front. It's kind of SimCity for real. It's the easiest way to think of it is, like, we've all played this game where you build different things in the city and you see how the simulated city responds. That is what urban simulation is. We try and keep it behavioral. We pay a lot of attention to how people are actually behaving. So in the Plan Bay Area case, what they're trying to do is to create a bunch of a set of policies, a policy package, if you will, and they'll come up with, in the Plan Bay Area case, there were 5 different scenarios that were different packages of policies, and they would simulate these packages of policies to find out what the outcomes of interest to them would be under those different policies. So these are the kinds of knobs that you can pull. Zoning for where land use can go, fees and subsidies to incentivize more efficient land uses, growth boundaries, natural land preservation, and then on the transportation side, you can add transit lines, create new highways, add new lanes. Parking policies, especially in San Francisco, are fascinating. And road pricing, we never really have, but we love to talk about. We do have tolling. The outputs are triple bottom line sorts of things. Everyone has something they care about the most. We get asked to predict a lot of different things. Economic, environmental, and social equity, safety, certainly one of those things. There are a lot of different things that people are considering. We do our best to represent all of them. We represent them at different levels of quality and accuracy. So the results in the Plan Bay Area, the task is these goals set forward in AB 32, which are to reduce emissions by 50% from the 1990 levels by 2035. So instead of going up, we're going down. But lots of other triple bottom line motivation as well, including some basic things like how's the region population so that we don't have lots of in-commuting from Sacramento. Economic competitiveness, right now that is not the problem. Preserving the natural environment, that sort of thing. And the strategy looks like this. These are not my slides. These are the MTC is our regional body. These are MTC's slides. So this is what I do from their perspective. The goal is to house, what does it say, 80% of new jobs and 5% of the region's land. These are the priority development areas. These are the pink areas on this map. It's worth noting that not everyone likes this plan. Some people abhor this plan. When we take this to public meetings, I don't know if I should say we. MTC gets yelled at. The conversation is usually very disruptive and not highly interactive and productive. The Tea Party usually attends these meetings. There's Karen Frick actually has research on how this went, so refer to her paper for detail. But I can tell you my personal experience, which is that there are a handful of people who travel from county to county to every meeting to yell and disrupt the meetings. And I will say there is a certain element of I have understanding for that perspective. When you look at a map like this, you are certain people see this and say, you're trying to force us into multifamily housing. We don't want to be in multifamily housing. I think there's some association of multifamily housing with communism and socialism, and that it all sort of comes from there. So keep in mind, this is an extremely politicized context. It all goes back to community engagement and the debate about what people want their region to look like. It's not just an analytical exercise. So ultimately, these are the five scenarios laid out in columns. The biggest number from the land use side is percentage of households and percentage of jobs going into PDAs, those are the pink areas. And so these would be some sort of concentrated set of those pink areas. And under the no project, which is sort of business as usual, 28% will go there. Under the preferred scenario, we predict that 37% of households will go into the PDAs. It's not entirely clear if that's enough to meet sort of AB 32 goals. They're not actually required to meet those goals. They're just required to have a process, consider different alternatives, and then people can weigh in on those alternatives. In reality, there's a lot more numbers that come out of this. Again, five scenarios and columns, different metrics, commute time, VMT, a lot of affordable housing concerns. MCC actually got sued for not representing affordable housing accurately enough, and has invested a lot of money in the past year and probably the next year in representing affordable housing and these models and sets of policies to aid with affordable housing. Any questions at this point? I can sort of pause for air.
So where does certain the role of MTC come in? So what's the interaction between certain MTC and Sin City in terms of who's doing what?
We're a consulting firm, and so they hire us to
do
consulting. We do the land use models for a number of different regions. I was primarily involved with MTCs. They collect data, they process the results and present them in public. They guide us as to what they want to see. We do most of the analytical and programming.
So the projections are coming out from simulations being done, I mean the behavioral modeling and the simulations being done through your work?
Okay. Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. Small qualification. So we focused on the land use side.
Okay.
There's a whole other model that we did not have anything to do with, which is the transportation side. It's the travel model.
Okay.
We are now being engaged in another project to start improving their travel model and writing a new one, in fact, but it will be some years before that's in practice. Yeah. Okay, so Urban Sim is the land use model. How does it work? It's an agent-based simulation of these regional, and the Bay Area region in this case. We simulate real estate market primarily because our job is primarily to predict where buildings will be built and where households and jobs will be placed in those buildings. Our clients are primarily regional governments. I can't emphasize enough that it's as much of a programming exercise as it is a modeling exercise. I was a software engineer for almost 10 years, just had nothing to do with city planning for 10 years, just doing software engineering, and then became interested in city planning and got into the field because I was a software engineer, and there wasn't enough rigorous software engineering in the field. That is changing, especially since Paul moved to the Bay Area, and there's a lot of good talent around here, but I will say that the theory of urban sim is independent of the implementation. There have been at least three implementations, software implementations of urban sim. One was in Java in 2000, and there was on written in Python in 2006, and then I started rewriting UrbanSim and the new Python tools a couple years ago. UrbanSim was created by Paul Waddell, who's the chair of city planning at Berkeley. Started in around 2000 and the seminal paper is in 2002, which you can find in Google Scholar and read. Every modeling system has a flowchart of how the models interact. Every model sort of represents a behavior that is of interest. The UrbanSim model has some more nuance than this, but this is pretty much it. There's a residential side and a non-residential side. And so I like to talk about the residential side because it's what we are familiar with as people, and just there's also this non-residential side. We have models for price. So think about when you're buying a house, the things that you're willing to pay for, local accessibility, access to amenities, school districts, regional job markets, safety, all these sorts of things are variables in our model. And we will take something like MLS listing or Redfin data and figure out what people are paying for, different segments of people having different preferences. There are a lot of different options as to how you can model these things. But there is a model of price so that in future years when things change, we can predict a new price 20, 30 years from now. In reality, price is the thing that drives this more than anything else, and price is also the hardest thing to model. To model price 3 months from now is an enormous challenge. To model price 25 years from now is nearly impossible. But we do the best we can, and it provides some element of objectivity to what would otherwise just be sort of a value-based discussion. We also have a model for household location choice. So in this model, things like families prefer bigger yards and other school districts, whereas young single people prefer to be in the city, and there's a probability distribution around that since no two people are the same. And then you might say the Bay Area is getting younger or it's not getting younger, and how do those preferences impact essentially price? And then household transition and relocation is how often people move for different sort of Asian demographic classes. And the household transition is adding households to regions, so growth or decline. We do model in Detroit, which has some areas in decline, so that's kind of interesting. And then the developer model models feasibility of building buildings based on prices and the relative competition of different land uses, like residential versus office in different places. So some places will office will price out residential, and other places residential will price out office. We do this within the context of zoning, so allowed uses, and where these different, in the United States, planning can be quite specific, and we respect the zoning that is given to us by the local jurisdiction. So UrbanSim looks something like this, and this is a web map. Let's see. So the people on the phone have to just listen to this, I guess. but this is an interactive demo of a simulation of UrbanSim. So yellow represents residential, blue is commercial. I can turn off one or the other or both. And so we can get these sort of high-level maps. I'll switch to diagnostic outputs and residential units and a better color scheme. And so this is sort of blue bluer areas are where we predict more growth to go. Now, I should tell you right up front that this is not like a final simulation or anything. This happened to be one I was working on the other day and put up for the demo. You can click on any zone in the Bay Area, and you can see how it changes over time. There's sort of major projects going in east and southeast San Francisco. There's a major project going in over here next to Jack London Square. And then Emeryville and West Oakland have some potential for growth as well. And then I believe there's a lot of growth in the South Bay as well. And you can sort of zoom in on these. So underneath, this would be a, like, GIS map of residential units in the Bay Area. And you're looking for general trends. We're not trying to predict exact buildings. If I thought I could predict the exact building where it would go, I would be a real estate developer and I would be a trillionaire. We're doing the best we can with the data we have available. So I'll zoom in on these units, and underneath every one of these things, when you zoom in far enough, is actually a project. That project has cash flow accounting as to whether it's profitable or not. This is sort of an empty lot in South San Jose. It might actually be built on by now. This satellite imagery is probably from a couple years ago. I've run analyses with current prices in places like San Francisco and vetted it with where developments are actually going in. And a lot of time you'll click on parcels and double-check it with satellite imagery, and there will be cranes there with a big hole in the ground. A lot of this stuff is not rocket science. There are huge places in the Bay Area where the prices certainly justify construction, and there are huge places where the prices do not. And so this level of it, I think, is fairly perhaps quite accurate, not on like a parcel-by-parcel basis, not like this exact building is going to flip in this exact year, not like that, but in a general sense, like this submarket has a lot of demand for elements, and this submarket has no demand. What's hard is predicting price in future years and how people's preferences change. I should point out, if your reaction is anything like mine, let's go to like downtown Oakland. Well, I mean, you can sort of get the impression here. If your reaction is anything like mine, you almost have a visceral reaction to how much growth there's going to be. This is over like 10 years or something like that, and there's 40 or 50 projects. The character of downtown Oakland in this simulation is going to change dramatically. I have a visceral reaction to this. I think it's terrifying. And I like dense urban environments. I also think the alternative is kind of terrifying, where we build from here to Sacramento or here to Los Angeles. I think I always like to emphasize that even though there's complicated math and it's a complicated simulation and people are going to question the assumptions and whether it's valid and whether it's accurate, don't lose track that one of the most important purposes for this is just an accounting exercise. If 2 million households are going to move to the Bay Area, they're going to fill up this much built space, and this is one alternative for what that much built space looks like. And there's some other alternative that where we go far more suburban, and in fact there are alternatives in between. And we don't get to control how much growth is coming. We can only impact through policies which sort of future we might prefer and build the infrastructure to support that. It's all kind of scary when you think about it. So it's up to sort of an informed debate as to what we want to see out of our region in the future as to how we can get there. I always end up in debates over this coefficient on that variable is wrong and what if people's preferences change, blah, blah, blah. That's important, but it's also important to just know that this is one case of what it could look like for that also come for that much growth to happen. I think this is the land use side. This is what I have for Linus. Are there any questions at this point?
So are these projections coming out from a particular instance of the simulation, or are these?
Yeah.
Okay. And you input proposed project and everything from the real estate market as input for it? I mean, because in some of the trends that you showed had this huge spike, which it seems sort of...
All of those projects are not in this. We do take and collect information on real estate developments that are actually in the pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
And many of those are sort of government encouraged projects like Treasure Island and Hunters Point Shipyard and things that are not market taking, they are market making. You know, we're going to build a whole city and we're going to provide all the infrastructure, new amenities. Urban Sim will never get that right. Like, that is driven by a few people to just change
the whole, yeah.
So Urban Sim is in the business of market taking around those sorts of assumptions. Design, if we can get Treasure Island to do this, or if we can get Hunters Point to do this, and then fill other things in with our predicted prices. So we try and deal with both sides of that. So that's the land use side. And then there's the transportation side, which is not so similar. I've written two half-finished transportation models in my life, so I'm not as familiar with this side as the other side, but I have some familiarity with it, so I'm happy to speak to that. This is sort of the simplest transportation model. This is walk score. People in this room mostly familiar with walk score. A measure from 0 to 100 of how walkable a neighborhood is. It combines, it is an index of the distance to 10 or 15 different amenities like restaurants and coffee shops and grocery stores. If you look at a map comparing walk score to walking, they are not the same thing. Walkability and walking are not the same thing. People don't walk in many places that are quote-unquote walkable. In particular, this map is far greener than the map of places where people actually walk. And my personal take on that is that walk score is a business that is in the business of selling homes, and so their incentive is to bias walk scores up so that people will not complain about them and buy fewer homes. That said, walk score is awesome. Like, I'm so glad that they made a metric on something that is valuable to me so that many, many people in the world can begin to think about this sort of thing. The workhorse of all travel modeling is still this four-step sort of aggregate transportation analysis zones model where you, again, this is a flowchart I took from a textbook. Every regional model has a flowchart like this. The four steps are trip generation, so how different people of different kinds of demographics make different trips. So I make, say, roughly 1.5 shopping trips a day, 2 commute trips, 0.5 trips to the bank, that sort of thing. Trip distribution is where I'm going. So given different amounts of different things in the city, I'm going to somewhere when I travel, so I'm going to model where I'm going. Mode choice is what mode I'm going to take to get there, so car, bike, walk, transit are the biggest ones, although there's some others. And then trip assignment is what route I'm going to take, and it's primarily on the traffic side, cars, in congestion, and how people substitute different modes at different times of day or don't even make a trip as the roads get congested. The state of the art actually looks something more like this. I am not going to talk about this because there's a lot of boxes. It's complicated. They have spent this first came out from a project of MIT, a dissertation at MIT 25 years ago or something like that. And they've been adding behavioral nuance to this is activity-based travel modeling for 25 years. Numerous people have been working on this, adding behavioral nuance, carpooling, how people coordinate trips between households, how people respond to tolling. People want to ask questions with this model, like what's going to happen in the future with self-driving cars, or if we impose road pricing, all that sort of thing. It's quite complicated. In some ways, it's actually easier than the land use model, though, because this is also used to test, like, what if I raise the toll from $6 to $8 on the Bay Bridge, and how many fewer people are going to go on the Bay Bridge? And there's a lot more knowns about that. We're dealing with, the current year. We have a pretty good idea of who lives in the Bay Area right now, and where they work, and how they make those choices. Take that for what you will. This is not just geared towards the 30-year time horizon, although it is used in that context. They will actually use this for policy decisions that are made today. San Francisco used their model for, like, the Octavia Street improvements and how they restructured their streets to get onto the Central Freeway. And everyone has told me that they did they made the street improvements and the model and what actually happened agreed to a sort of a remarkable degree. And I like to bring this map up as, remember what we are actually modeling. We are modeling trips that are happening across the region. Okay, I'm gonna just play this one. So this is the kind of thing that we're modeling, where we're modeling simulated households, where they're going to go, what modes they're going to take, and in a sort of statistical pattern. This is actually observed behavior in the regional travel survey. And it's an animated map, so every pulse is an hour in the day, and we're going over the 24 hours in the day for this travel survey. I took an isolated one suburb in the northeast part of Mexico City, and I like Mexico City because they have a lot of different kinds of public transit, and you can go from one income class to another and see the different patterns change. You can also move to New York and the Bay Area for the travel surveys that I have. This is mode split over here, so Colectivo and Transit is by far the most popular mode in Mexico City. And then I think I broke this the other day, but I can't show you. You can see the visceral patterns of, I put the data in the wrong place. One of our servers crashed, so I had to move the data. But I'll fix this and put this back up. But at least you can see it in Mexico City. But the patterns are sort of visceral, so like you can go to New York and see a lot more travel by transit in downtown Manhattan and just see all the automobile traffic in Los Angeles. People traveling further distances, everything is blue, which is travel by car, that sort of thing. You can also see daily activity patterns, which are a big part of this model. You can see that in places like New York, people actually work until like 8 p.m. and San Francisco, everybody's gone home by 5, which is something I know from experience to be fairly true. So what comes out of the regional travel model, the transportation model, is all of the trips that are taken by all of the people in the Bay Area and roughly what transportation zones they're going to, what their mode splits are, what their distribution of trip distances are, and it's from that that we can take other metrics like vehicle miles traveled and then get to greenhouse gases. Advanced models I've seen actually take into account fleet composition, so whether people are driving trucks or electric cars and how that impacts greenhouse gases and that sort of thing. But after running one of these simulations, there are a number of different metrics that we will use that people are really interested in getting to. Any questions on that? I think that's what I have on the travel models. So I can take some time to talk about other transportation metrics. Pandana is a network library that we have, which measures walk score like things. So if you need walk score, but you need it to be customized somehow, Pandana is a library that allows you to do that. So this came out of my dissertation work, and one of the biggest problems with traditional GIS and spatial analysis is that they'll take non-overlapping polygons and say count the number of households or the average income within those polygons, when in fact those polygons don't really exist in the real world. What really exists are people traveling along transportation networks. Walk score sort of got that right. So we created a framework for doing analysis with that as sort of the core principle. So this is a buffer query around the point. The point is this red dot in the center. I don't, you barely see the red dot, but the purple is what's within the zone. These are all the parcels within the zone, and we can aggregate like average income of all the people that live in the buildings in the purple. And we can do that for the whole region. And we can do it in less than a second. So this is walk score computed on OpenStreetMap data for San Francisco. It looks a lot better in high resolution. Like, I won't turn it around because I'm going to lose the connection. But it looks really great here. I look good there. But we have highly detailed metrics that come from that. We, at Simplicity, have started building 3D software to visualize this in ways that are... Some people find this less interpretable. I think it's more intuitive in many ways. This is sushi access in San Francisco. So this is an aggregation of sushi restaurants within a kilometer and a half. So definitely the rich men in San Francisco have quite a bit of sushi access. Like I said, you can do this, 24 frames a second. Basically, you can do this in real time. So you're recomputing walk score or some other metric in real time in this 3D environment. So what our company primarily does is do this in 3D at this point, compared to static 2D polygons. We used to do it before. So here you can actually see we're going to do it for the whole region at once. This is aggregating information like what's used in walk score. So this is accessibility to probably shopping. No, this is restaurants. So this is all the restaurants within half a kilometer, and then themes from red to green, so red are the hot spots. You can take averages, you can do mins, maxes, standard deviations. You can apply different decays so that things further away count less or not as much. Here I'm expanding and reducing the radius. So, you can have sort of micro or meso or macro effects. It's interesting. This is sort of my mental map of San Francisco. So I guess my mental map has a lot to do with food. on the left is shopping and on the right is food. There's a lot of correlation, but they're not the same thing. And you can modify them independently. What's interesting is you can apply it to things that aren't walk score-like. So this is actually the regional travel survey, probably destinations of transit. So you can see these hot spots around BART stations, and then the left is destinations by car. So you can see a much more focused pattern on the right and a distributed pattern on the left. And then...
And the distances are computed along the network? I mean...
Yes. So we took, like, the local street network from OpenStreetMap and just put it in there. So, you know, you're not going to jump across bodies of water and places you can't reach quickly. That has to do with how you can actually, what you can actually get to. Okay. Saw the slide I was looking for in there. There you go. And then our hope is to create this next generation planning tool where you can interactively design the 3D city and get these sort of metrics out relatively instantaneously. Maybe it's not perfectly instantaneous. Or maybe there's sort of a spectrum of what you can get. This is a greenfield development that was done in conjunction with CalThorpe and Associates for a project in India. It's just sort of an initial prototype of a new greenfield city that can go in there. And you can actually edit whole districts at a time, lay out different place types and different places of the city, change the street grids. One of the co-founders of the company actually got his PhD in computer graphics and designing cities. This is where the analogy with SimCity for Real really starts to make sense. And then you can, the idea is to have analysis built into the same environment so that you can get out analytical metrics immediately from the designs that you're putting in. So if you're a designer from the very early design stages, you can get out mode splits and BMT and greenhouse gas emissions like as soon as possible, quickly as possible. And I think there's some visualization of that later on. Feel free to go and sort of check this out. But actually, like, change the parcel sizes. This is changing the setbacks, distribution of trees to give it a different feel, number of parks that are in the city. And then I think it's interesting when you start looking at the output. This is like Sonic Clearer. With, you know, this has an actual latitude and longitude on the world and summing Sonic Clearer over the course of the year, and areas that are blue have low or no sun exposure, and areas that are yellow have a lot of sun exposure. So you can get heat island effects and you know, things that the residents will care about too, which is like having sunlight in their buildings. And you can compare different alternatives for their sun exposure properties. So that's where we're going now and what we're working towards, is to have 3D interactive design with the metrics. Questions? I think that's all I have. Yeah.
You mentioned you're at least thinking about developing transportation models. What sort of direction are you going that would be different than what's available?
That's a great question. We're doing it in collaboration with a number of MPOs. So we're doing it with the Bay Area, with San Diego, and with Atlanta. So we get to advise them, but we don't really get to drive the agenda. They still kind of like the complicated methodologies that they have. They just want a simpler way of doing it. But they also don't know if all the complication is worth it. I think one of the biggest things is coordinating within households is one of the most complicated things. Capture and these models. And sometimes the complication doesn't actually represent behavior more accurately. I mean, that's one of my biggest sort of overarching issues with modeling right now, is that you don't start with the premise of like a behavior you're trying to represent and then represent it in different ways and test it against that to see if you're actually doing a better or worse job. You just sort of represent what you know is true for that one piece of behavior and then know that it must be true for the whole system. It doesn't always work out that way. So I think making some simplifications like that probably doesn't affect the overall outcome like that. It makes it a much more easy to run, easy to understand, easy to make changes as a model system. I don't see the, like, flowcharts of models approach going anywhere anytime soon. I mean, governments tend to be pretty conservative, and they tend to stick with what's worked with them in the past, and so I think it's going to stick around for a while. I don't know if that answered your question perfectly, but it's just some thoughts. Do you have any?
Well, one of the things that's under consideration for the future is road networks that are controlled dynamically.
Yeah.
And for a goal of reducing emissions. And I'm wondering if...
So there's an enormous grant from the National Air Resources Board, or DARPA, HRPA, $10 to $20 million, depending on exactly this. So, like, with the advent of mobile devices and the ability to understand where people are, can you actually make the transportation system more efficient and reduce emissions and energy use? It's tough. Like, people are working on it. There are certainly proposals. To me, it's baffling that everyone in transportation knows that highways are not at maximum flow, and so they are clearly not in any way as efficient as they could be. And to me, you have to start from the principle that they should be at maximum flow, and we have to do whatever it takes to get them there. But in reality, as long as it's free, everyone is going to maximize their own interest, and they're all going to get on freeway, and congestion will happen, and traffic will happen, and the freeways will close to a standstill. So it essentially comes down to political will to solve the problem. Every traffic engineer knows how to solve the problem. You just somehow keep people from entering the freeway at the congested times. But who gets to enter and who doesn't is the big issue there. Yeah.
I'm wondering if you have considered in the models or MTC, which I think they have to, consider the issue of affordable housing and the potentially inverse relationship between walkable communities and affordable housing. Because what I've read is that as communities become more walkable, then housing prices go up, and then the communities that have lived there before it was walkable, communities who are often walking, can't stay. So.
Yeah, that's right. So I always wonder when I hear these, when people say it's going to have social equity and environmental sustainability effects, and they always sort of get lumped in together, and they're just not the same thing. Like, you can often get a environmental outcome without the, you know, social outcome, or the other way around. And in this case, you're probably correct. I mean, so research is also being done on this right now. Paul's actually working on this, that as higher income people are starting to value these communities again, they're moving into walkable communities, driving anyway, and forcing the poor people who were walking into suburban communities and having to drive as best they can. I don't think anyone knows the answer to that. My feeling is that it's probably net positive anyway, but don't know that for sure. I don't know. That's, we'll have to look at travel surveys and see what actually happens.
Yeah.
And it's the law of unintended consequences, right? And, honestly, when I run these simulations, I see the law of unintended consequences all the time. It's like, why is it doing that? Oh, well, there's some response that makes no sense. But also things that don't make a ton of sense end up happening all the time in reality. So sometimes it's hard to know.
Well, eventually it'd be ironic if you have, community activists joining the Tea Party against some of this land you're planning, right?
Absolutely. And, it happens more than you think. I think one of Karen Frick's papers is actually on one of those, what do they call it, strange bedfellows or something like that. And the Tea Party and the Sierra Club actually got together. We all hate it for different reasons, for the same reasons. All of the MPOs, they always get sued by both sides. It is a game of lawsuits, and it's like squeaky wheel gets the grease, and you feel like you have to go in and sue the government in order for your side to be heard and sue louder than other people so that it airs more to your side. But then occasionally people are on the same side.
In the case of the real estate models, how do you cross-validate the performance of whatever model that you use?
So that's a great question. It doesn't happen as much as you think. Every person with a computer science background will say, like, how are you even running a model without...
Rigorous
validation.
Yeah, it's also difficult to cross-validate the third-year
So, what my usual answer to this is, because we're doing land use, we're dealing with things on, at least a 10-year timescale or 15-year timescale. Even on a 10-year timescale, you'll sometimes get cycles, like the boom-bust stuff. And, by the time we've looked 15 years ago, the data in 2000 is completely different.
Yeah.
So you're going to make the argument, why am I even looking at the data from 15 years ago? Because the data's improved so much that now we're just going to move forward with what we've got. I'm not going to limit myself to the data that we had 15 years ago in order to test what I would have predicted 15 years ago and test it against what I know happened. That's not an acceptable answer to me. but it is state of the practice. If you can think of a better one, I'd love to hear it.
And also, I guess a related question would be that, so the agency is interested in the targets are sort of macroscopic and sort of aggregated. And my understanding of agent level sort of agent based modeling is that it's fairly microscopic, and sort of as you zoom in, you have stuff being predicted on a particular parcel and it's fairly zoomed in.
Mm-hmm.
So to what extent is the detail necessary and useful, given that there could be multiple scenarios which might lead to the same aggregated, and so how do you value the microscopic detail versus what's coming up at the aggregated level.
That's right. I'm not sure I know the answer to that one either. It's something that's constantly being debated. You'll see where everybody's diving down and now we've gotten to the most precise level and now some people are coming back up to these aggregated models. And my personal opinion is that getting to the actual parcel of land ownership has a lot of relationship to reality, and people can zoom into a parcel and see that it exists, and the policies always exist on a parcel-by-parcel basis, what you're allowed to build on that parcel. So that is probably the right level of abstraction. I also think that even though a lot of housing is going to go in. A lot of it's multifamily housing, so a number of large projects going in. It's quite small, like, and by small I mean a couple thousand maybe. And I don't see any reason why you wouldn't just hand check them, just go through one by one. Like, it's not that hard of things to look at 2,000 different possible projects and say, no way, maybe, definitely, go down the list. And for everyone that you say no way, you take that off the table and simulate again until you have a vetted result that people think is plausible to the parcel level. To me, that's what the future should be. It's like humans actually saying, yeah, okay, I got it.
We're actually out of time. So thank you so much for coming. You could be putting a round of applause.